it is going.
Oh, is it going?
No. Okay.
Okay. So well, I'm gonna wrap this up fast, but we got so that we could fly, and we were sent out almost immediately on our first mission, and that was a real frightening experience because we didn't have the slightest idea what to expect, and we had been hearing the ones that had flown their full tour of missions talking in the barracks, and they were telling all these experiences that we thought were totally exaggerated, you know.
They're not.
So we flew number 1, 2, 3, 4. We flew 4 missions, and I think the reason that they were as calm as they were what we call PFF missions. That means that we had cloud cover.
Oh.
And the Germans could not see us to shoot their 88 millimeters at us accurately. And so on the 5th mission, we had a clear mission, and the mission was Berlin.
Oh, my.
And we knew that they amassed everything that they had in the way of guns whenever there was a mission into Berlin. And so we headed in there, and like I said, it was a clear day, and you can see everything. We was flying in formation at 27,500 feet. That's about 7 miles up. And still we could see the ground very plainly from anything like a flash or something like that. Well, we would go in, and as we went in on a mission, they would call out that we were on the IP, the initial point.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got to the IP, every mission we flew, that meant that you was on automatic pilot. And, well, I'm making a noise. On automatic pilot, and you was flying straight ahead at the same speed, direction, and everything. Nothing was varied. And it was, the automatic pilot was tied into the Norden bomb sight. And we flew into the target, and the bombardier dropped his bombs at that time.
Uh-huh.
And when he said bombs away, we were on intercom so that everybody could hear what was going on.
And then you were having to watch for the other German planes?
Yes. We happened to be fortunate enough that we didn't have very much fighter opposition at all. We were only attacked. Out of 34 missions, we were only attacked 5 times by enemy fighters.
Uh-huh.
And so flak was our enemy. I mean, we feared that a lot more than we did enemy planes. We were attacked 3 times by Me-109s and twice by German jets. That was, the Germans had jets long before we did.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was in the battle.
Yeah.
They put them right into battle. And on both of those occasions when we were attacked, it was just a single jet. One time it was a one-engine jet, and one time it was a twin-engine jet. And they attacked us from the rear, and I was in my gun position and had wings framed on them and everything, and was just ready to pull the trigger. Boom, it's gone. Just like that. I mean, they're that much faster than the pursuit plane.
I see.
And so I never did fire on a jet because they was just too fast. We fired on the Me-109s, and as far as I know, we didn't hit them too much, but we wasn't all that worried about fighters, but the flak was really bad.
Oh, I'll bet.
And it was thick enough up there you could get out and walk on it, we used to say, and it was black as an ace of spades when it blew up. Well, it was just a great big black puffball.
Oh, my.
And we was about ready to drop our bombs, and our lead plane, we fly in B formation, and the lead plane just disintegrated right in front of us.
Oh, geez.
We had to take evasive action, had to take over before we got in on the target and to keep from losing our airplane down through the mess, you know. And then they went back to to the automatic pilot and put it on bomb sight to drop our bombs after that incident happened. But that's the one of the most frightening things that ever happened to me in the whole war was that instance, because I swear to this day that I saw the top turret gun position go floating past us with a gunner in it.
Oh, well, you probably
and
did.
So, there was no parachutes came from that airplane. It just totally blew it apart. So.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we got to get you back home.
Yeah, but we flew 34 missions over Germany, and then we had a choice. Our pilot and co-pilot needed to advance one more rank in order to get to the rank that they were supposed to be. So they didn't have that in place, and so they told the enlisted men that they could take a 10-day leave of absence, or we could fly with another crew and fly our last mission. We had to fly 35 missions. And we definitely did not want to fly our last mission with a strange crew. So,
uh-huh.
So we took the 10-day leave of absence and went to Scotland. And while we was up there, the war ended.
Oh, good.
So we came back.
Got to see Scotland.
Yeah, we came back to the base after the 10-day leave of absence, and I flew two missions with a captain in our outfit. The first mission was to take ground troops in to the Ruhr Valley, we call it, on the Rhine River, so that they could see some of the destruction that took place, because they had promised them that they would do that when the war ended, if they did a good job with their taking care of the airplanes. So I went on one of those missions, and then I went on one mission to pick up prisoners of war. And they were English flyers that had been in the prison camp for probably up to 4 years.
Oh, my.
And they were just skin and bones. We loaded 35 of them in this B-17 on a short brick runway.
I bet they were so glad to see you.
Yeah, and we took them off, and we had to lock the brakes on the B-17 on the very end of the runway, and turn the engines clear up to full speed, and just as we took off, we kicked in the exhaust-driven turbines to give us extra power, and we just barely able to raise off that short brick runway with those
because you had so many extra people.
Yeah, we had a 34 people as more load than what we had when we had the ammunition and so forth, and there was only 12 of us on there.
Tell about meeting this guy in Las Vegas.
So anyway, there was a guy, an English flyer on that plane, that he said to me, do you think I could fly this? And I said, well, I don't know. I'm just an engineer gunner, you know, but I'll ask the pilot. So I got down by the pilot and I said, there's a guy here that wants to fly the plane. Is that possible? And he got up and he stretched and he turned to the co-pilot and he says, watch this guy, he's going to fly. He says, I'll take fives. So the plane was so loaded that the pilot had to kind of trade places with this guy, and I was right there too, and I was all crunched up there with all these guys. And so that guy took over and he flew for about 10 minutes. And he was just ecstatic. I mean, he'd
never flown before?
Well, yeah. He was a Stirling pilot.
Oh, okay.
A big four-engine English bomber when he was shot down, taken prisoner.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, it was just 4 or 5 years ago that we were in Las Vegas, Nevada, and they brought a bunch of English people over to kind of pay them back for them giving us all this party at the 50th anniversary of the 8th Air Force in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we was in the memorabilia room where we was talking, where they keep all the stuff that you want to look at and pictures. And this guy was talking, and he was telling about being liberated from the prisoner of war camp. And when he got to a certain place, well, I knew that he had to be the guy that asked me if he could fly that plane.
And so you got to talk to him?
Yeah, and I said, let me finish the story, will you? And he looked at me kind of funny, and I says, I'm the guy that you ask if you could fly the plane. "You are!" And he gave me a great big hug.
Oh, for God's sake.
And so it turned out that after all those years, here was this guy, and he didn't, you know, I remembered him as a very, very skinny guy with a pot belly, and he was a pretty handsome-looking guy. So it was quite a reunion, and I just couldn't believe something like that would happen.
That was wonderful. Yeah, it certainly was.
Yeah.
Well, I got to get you back living here in Colt.
So I come back from the war. My dad had sold his place and moved up here, and so I was told to get the horses together down there because we still wasn't in the full tractor age back then, and plow the sugar beets. And my dad had a hired man that he'd left behind that was the truck driver and the overseer of the Japanese people that topped our sugar beets that fall. And there was a big bunch of those Japanese people, and they could really work hard and top a lot of sugar beets. And so I rounded up them horses, and there was some of them that was quite old and some that were almost colts. And I started plowing these sugar beets. And I'd plow long days, and I couldn't keep ahead of those Japanese. And the poor horses, they hadn't been working, and they were just about melting. So the hired man said to me, he said, "Bert," he says, you can't keep enough sugar beets plowed for them." And I says, "Boy, I'm giving them horses all they can stand." So he said, "Well, we got to do something." So he says, "I'm going to look. There's people that's..." We had a little tractor there, but it wasn't rigged up so we could put a beet puller on it. So he says, "There's people that's using these beet pullers behind the little tractor, so I'm going to see how they're doing that." So he did, and so on the weekend, when we wasn't topping beets, we slipped that puller onto that little tractor, and it got so that I could plow enough sugar beets with that tractor, more than what I could plow with horses, that I could plow just a regular day from daylight until a while before dark and keep plenty of sugar beets plowed for.
Oh, wasn't that great?
We finished them, and Dad came down, and he was making the final move, and so he had a truck and a car that needed to be driven back here, and we pulled a four-wheel trailer back and brought all of his remaining stuff. I drove the truck, and he drove the car. And my wife, Eileen, we got married after we come back from World War II. She loaded in with me, and we came up to Oregon. And we had already decided that...
That was what year?
Yeah, that was 1945 in the fall.
Okay.
Just a while after I got out of the military and plowed the sugar beets out of them. And... of course, we didn't have a place to stay here, so we moved in with Mom and Dad. And we stayed there till the next spring, and we got this place that we live on now, and moved out. And she was a very happy girl, because no girl wants to be a newlywed.
Oh, no, it's hard to live with in-laws. Very hard. I've been there, done that. They wanted me to ask you what you knew about the Hendershots. That's who had this place originally, isn't it?
All I know is that the reason that I'm sure that we got this place is because the Allens had got this place after the Hendershots had long since built it and so forth. And when we came up to talk to Herman Allen about buying the place, he said that this was really a well sought after place because of having this Hendershot house on it. And
how many acres?
There was 150 acres then.
With the house?
30 of it across the road and 120 here by the house.
Uh-huh.
And so he said that after talking with us, that it turned out that Eileen was talking with Mrs. Allen, and she says, "Do you know why you was able to buy that place?" And she says, "No, why?" And she says, "Well," she says, "when I looked out the window and saw your husband, Burton, they had a son named Everett, and he was killed in a railroad accident in Nampa. He said, when I looked out the window, I saw my dead son.
For heaven's sake.
And so she said, when Herman came to the house, she asked him, who was that out there? And he said it was Mr. Hill and his son Burton that's just come home from the war. And he says, we're going to sell him our place, aren't we? And he says, yes, Marie.
Oh, for God's sake.
So that's how we happened to get this place. I don't know that we would have got it, but
otherwise,
it was something.
But you brought your son that had just got back from the war, and that cinched the deal, huh?
Yeah. She said that I looked just like Everett.
Oh my gosh!
I stood up.
Oh my gosh! That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So.
But it's been a good farm.
How many kids have you had here?
We had six.
Okay. Yeah. And you say, are some of them work on the farm?
Nope.
Just you and Eileen,
the,
huh?
Yeah. What happened when 1961, I was working for the railroad here in LeGrand, and I was asked to become the electrical supervisor for the Idaho Division, headquartered in Pocatello, Idaho.
Uh-huh.
And I almost turned that position down because I couldn't see how that I could possibly. We had rental property in LeGrand and was living in LeGrand and farming the farm by remote control. And so I said, Eileen, what do you think? I can't take that job, can I? And she says, we're going to take it.
Uh-huh, good for her.
And I had to tell my boss that I either wanted the job or I didn't want it. So I phoned him and told him I decided I'd take the electrical supervisor job. So on our wedding anniversary date in 1970, I found myself headed for Pocatello, Idaho to get cued in to be the electrical supervisor.
Uh-huh.
And so I went down and got some training and became the electrical supervisor of Idaho from 1970 to 1981.
So Eileen moved there, didn't you?
Yeah,
you guys lived there.
Eileen sold her property and rented the property that we didn't want to sell here, and she moved down there, and we lived there from.
Oh, so you sold the ranch that you'd bought?
No, we didn't sell the ranch. We sold the property in town.
In town. Oh, okay.
Rentals and all that stuff, but we kept the farm.
Well, remember when you was there on Adams and you had the place? Is that one of the ones you sold?
No, we bought that one after we came back from Oaktel.
Oh, is that after you came back? That big old house?
We set up for a magic mill business in that, and we still was farming the farm by remote control. Because Tony Pedro farmed the farm until we got back, and then we took it over and started still living in LeGrand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still working for the railroad when I came back because I quit management and went back to the ranch. The last guy that ran this was Sylvan Sawyer, and Tony Pedro was the first guy.
Uh-huh.
So they
Sylvan ran the ranch, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And so then we took over after Sylvan, and what we did then, we put the whole farm in the Soil Conservation Reserve for 10 years. And that was.
What does that
just,
mean?
We just planted it to grass, and we had to keep the weeds out of the grass and leave it in the grass for that period of time.
So you didn't get any income off of it?
Yeah, we got income. They paid us $50 an acre.
Jeez.
To put it in a soil bank. That was supposed to help the wheat farmers out so that
I remember
so much.
That.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so then after that, come out of the soil bank, then we rented to a guy by the name of Edwin Troyer, who belongs to the Mennonite religion, and there's been a lot of them move into Cole.
Oh, yes. Nice
and,
people.
Nice people, and they... he was a real good farmer, too, and he farmed it then for... how long did Edwin farm this, Eileen?
Six.
6 years. And then Edwin, he had bought my dad's old place from Bob Hill, that bought it from my mom.
Bob and Jalita?
Yeah, Bob and Jalita.
Yeah.
And... So Edwin bought it then from Bob and Jolita, and then he found out how much he could get out of his farm, so he put it up for sale. And he got the money.
Uh-huh.
And so he sold his farm, and in turn, his boy had been helping him farm, and so we're signed up with his son, Curtis, now, and he rents the main farm here, 120 acres, year by year.
Uh-huh.
So we don't know.
So you're getting rental.
Yeah.
So we get. Well, I thought, I don't know, in my mind, I thought you had cherry orchard.
Yeah, it's right here, part of it. We didn't rent the house. There's 4 acres here that we kept off of that 120.
Yeah.
And then my brother Ralph's in the nursing home, and so I'm taking care of his 30 acres, and I have 20 more acres over there myself.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we're...
I just got to say, your house is so unique.
Yeah.
Because it's...
Yeah, this Hendershot now. We haven't said a lot about Hendershot, but James Hendershot and Dunham Wright are two of the old pioneers back in the 1870s that were developing this land here in the Grand Round Valley. Up till about that time, why it was pretty much lake, and they just farmed the east side and the west side of this big lake.
Oh.
And so this Hendershot was in politics quite a bit, and he was either a senator or a representative for a while down in Salem. And so they decided they was going to dig what they call the Big Ditch, and it goes and takes it takes Grand Round. How does that work? Anyway, it takes the water from what was the lake area of the Grand Round Valley straight through and dumped it back in the Grand Round River, and that helped a whole bunch for the flooding, because prior to that time, the Catherine Creek and the Grand Round River came down into this valley, and the only way out was the winding Grand Round River that had to wind around, and there was only 14 feet of fall from one end to the other. That's only 1 foot per mile.
Is that when they started working on that river?
Yeah, and so they wanted to dig that big ditch, and so Hendershot bid the contract on the big ditch.
Uh-huh.
And it sounded like he was going to get a lot of money, and I don't know what happened, whether he got all of the money or not, but anyway, it was, I think it was about $11,000 that was allotted for digging that ditch, and he happened to have access to equipment, and so he took the bid.
And this was in the 1800s?
That was about, it was in the 1800s, probably about 1880-something.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And he took the bid for that ditch, and he was able to build it for about half of what the bid was.
Well, yeah, because that was quite a bit of money in those days.
So anyway, he made some good money on that, and it was in 1870 that he was building on this house, and my son, Alan, is quite a historian, and he did a real in-depth study. And,
I think they have.
And he's
they have access to your son's.
Yeah, I think he puts the date when this house was completed at 1878,
uh-huh.
And it was built by Hendershot. And this house, according to abstracts and so forth, cost approximately $11,000 to
build. Gosh. And what is it, 100 and what years old now?
It's, that'd be 1877 till...
105, isn't
till
it?
Till now,
Well, 105, isn't
that something?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, and it's Gothic architecture, and it's registered in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. We found that out from... Conrad Head and another historian in LeGrand here at the college, that it was registered, because Conrad Head said he used to take tours through here from the college. They'd bring a busload out and take them through here. And he got to thinking, I have seen that house someplace before. So he went back to the college and researched, and he found that they had the blueprints of this in college over here.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's registered in the National Archives. So he gave us a copy of the blueprints. So we have the actual blueprints for this house. There was some changes made in this house when it was built from the blueprints, because it showed a straight staircase going up through this dining room, which is the center of this house, to the upper story. And he decided that he wanted a circular staircase, so he took part of this, what was supposed to be the dining room area, and made a circular staircase that goes up, and the dome of it ends up in the attic of this. And it was built round up at the top, because they cut little short boards,
yes,
and made it round, and then they used lath, the wood lath,
yes,
and molded it around that, and so they've got a perfectly round staircase here. So
is that staircase still here?
It's right here, yeah. It's still here.
I'll be darned.
It's where you come in when we get through here, while you take a look at it.
Yeah.
But it circles right up to the upper floor, and when we get in the attic, why, we can look down on the dome of it and so forth.
How many bedrooms are there upstairs?
There's a big bedroom up there now that we've changed it a little bit, and we've made a clothes closet out of part of it and a bathroom out of the other part of it, and it's still a big room. It was built so large, and they used it for a dance hall, believe it or not.
Oh, for God's sake. So there was plumbing up there that you could make access.
We had to take the plumbing up through from here.
Uh-huh.
And that's, we've had to put a false ceiling in this dining room to hide the plumbing and so forth. Yeah.
Well, I think it's marvelous.
It's a pretty unique building. And
treasure.
When you see how they had to do some of the lathe work and some of the architecture of this back in there. We'll take a look at that. This thing that's real fancy there in the bay window.
Yes.
See, there's some lathe work on that thing, and they got that lathe over in Union. Union had access to some wood lathe. And the curvature of that was made by taking a planed pine 1x6 and sawing little notches in it so they could bend it.
Yes.
And that's what forms that arch there. And so this house has got lots of what we call gingerbread on it, and we've tried to keep as much of that intact as we could. It used to have wood gingerbread down the ridge roll, and it rotted out completely, and so rather than to rebuild that, we had a metal one that looks similar.
Well, that's smart.
And the chimneys are the old style chimneys that hung on the walls, and they got condemned a few years ago, and so we had them rebuilt because they was in pretty poor shape, just so that it would save the architecture of the house, and then we capped them. We don't use them anymore.
Uh-huh.
And we've taken part of what used to be the dressing room. It was a long area here, and we used it for quite a few years when we first moved here. It was just a big long bathroom, had a shower and a bathtub both and so forth, but we took the back end of that and made it a furnace room and the front part of it now.
How did they heat this originally?
They heated it with wood stoves.
Oh, and, that's why all the chimneys, huh?
Yeah, see, there can be a pipe go into that chimney from that room and this room and this room and the bedroom and upstairs. There's places where you can get into them to the upstairs rooms too. So they
a lot of fires had, keep going.
Oh, up. They had fires. If they wanted to keep the whole house, they must have had to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They had to have at least 6 fires.
Oh, isn't that something?
With fires, yeah.
Okay.
But it has.